Democrat dysfunction in Miami-Dade. Could the party lose here? Saying so long to this aquarium and what it represents. And is a new wave of Haitian refugees imminent? Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll talk with Florida Democratic Party Chair Nikki Fried about her decision to suspend two of the party's South Florida chairpersons amid fears that Democrats could lose once reliable Miami-Dade County. We'll discuss Miami-Dade's decision to scrap the Sequarium and what a more 21st century use for that site is. And we'll examine whether Florida Governor Ron DeSantis's prep for more Haitian boat people is just more political grandstanding. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo. There's little debate anymore that Florida is now as red a state as Texas. But at least Democrats could count on South Florida remaining purple, if not true blue, right? Well, maybe not. A Miami Herald voter registration analysis shows that in the past 4 years, Democrats' advantage over Republicans in Miami-Dade County has been cut in half. So maybe it wasn't such a surprise this month when Florida Democratic Chair Nikki Fried suspended the party's Miami-Dade chairman, Robert Dempster, who's been in that seat since 2021. Fried called it, quote, part of an overall strategy to get Miami-Dade back on track for Democrats, who have most noticeably been hemorrhaging all-important Latino voters here. Fried this month also suspended the Palm Beach County Democratic chair, Mindy Koch, and the chair in Franklin County on Florida's Panhandle. Is Fried, who took over the reins last year, fixing an obviously broken state party or alienating its rank and file? What's your perspective? Are you a Florida Democrat? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is Florida Democratic Party Chair Nikki Fried. Chair Fried, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me on, and I'm definitely going to fight back on your narrative of it being a red state.
Well, that makes for a good conversation. I want to start with your decision this month to suspend Miami-Dade County Democratic Chairman Robert Dempster. Can you summarize for us why you took that action? We're told it's because the Miami-Dade party was, quote, out of compliance with the state's party's rules and bylaws. How so, Chair Fried?
Yeah, well, I think let's take a step back. And I saw, you know, was listening to your narrative, too, about Miami-Dade. And that's kind of part of the issue, you know, that we have to make sure that we are doing the work on the ground every single day,
right?
Knocking on doors, voter registration, getting people back on the vote by mail lists, making sure that we're recruiting candidates from school boards to congressional candidates all throughout the county. And unfortunately, we had seen time and time again in Dade County that that type of activity wasn't happening because Dade County is still blue. Dade County has only gone red twice in the history of the county. One was an outlier from last year, back when Jeb Bush was running for governor. And so in order for us to make sure that Dade County stays historically blue and continues to move forward and carry Joe Biden into the presidency, we have to make changes. And we've seen time and time again, when we keep doing the same things over and over again and expect a different result, that's just not going to be the case. And sometimes leadership means having to make some pretty tough, bold decisions. And unfortunately, that was a decision and a call that I had to make last week.
Right. In Mr. Dempster's case, there were also some complaints about mismanagement of party funds here. Does that relate to those miscues that you're talking about in terms of strategy and practice?
No, you know, I don't want to go into some of those financial stuff because that's ultimately not what the decision was about.
Okay.
Violations of bylaws, violations of our compliance issues, because you always know, you know, I know we're going into the weeds about local parties, but in order to know that there's the health of a local party is knowing that they're following the rules, their membership list, they're having consistent meetings on a normal basis. And unfortunately, that was just not happening. And so saw based on their lack of compliance, lack of ability to uphold the bylaws, that the health of the Miami-Dade DEC Democratic, executive committee locally was just not up to par. And if we're ever going to figure out a way to take back the state, fixing the problems in some of these local parties is part of the plan.
Now, I should also point out that the person who is now the acting Miami-Dade Democratic chair, Maria Elena Lopez, issued a statement objecting to your suspension of Mr. Dempster, given that important elections are obviously just months away. She also argues that the Miami-Dade party has received, quote, zero financial or administrative support from the Florida Democratic Party. Are her complaints valid at all?
Not even close.
Okay.
The reality is that the state parties, whether Democrat or Republican, no matter what state you're in, the local parties have a responsibility for local operations. That's everything from fundraising to recruiting of candidates. And so that was Miami-Dade's responsibility for funding. And if in fact the parties go on top of that for whether it's voter registration or it is even just staffing, as my good friend Jamie Harrison always says, we're not going to throw good money after bad. Mm-hmm. And so in order for us to feel like there was truly going to be an investment, not just for the Florida Democratic Party, but even as the Biden campaign is starting to roll out staffing across the country and making Florida a continued battleground, they had to see that Miami-Dade is operational. And it just wasn't. Mm-hmm. And it was the entire, a lot of the leadership in there. But unfortunately, you've got to take action. And too many people in our state, will suffer if we can't get this right.
So I just want to ask you to that point then, to her point that we are approaching local, state, and national elections that could see former President Trump and the Republicans win the once Democratic stronghold of Miami-Dade County. Did you take this action because you felt something drastic had to be done at this point to prevent that from happening?
Absolutely. Because it is so important. There's no other county in the entire country that all eyes are on. You don't hear about, Philadelphia, and you don't hear about New York City, and you don't hear about Savannah. You hear about Miami-Dade. And as we say that in order to fight back and to protect democracy, not just here in the state, but across the country, and frankly, where we are in international politics, the world, we had to make sure that Miami-Dade was on track to be doing the work. Because when we as Democrats lose, the people lose.
That's interesting that you say that. Why do you say Miami-Dade County is, for example, much more important in this regard than, say, New York? Your point is very interesting there.
Yeah, because look, Florida has been an under-organized, voter-suppressed state, and so when Democrats get to work, we can win. And so in order for the potential of us flipping the state and delivering it for Joe Biden, Miami-Dade has to be operational. And we know that we cannot win the state and we cannot deliver the votes for Joe Biden mm-hmm. without having Miami-Dade operational.
Let's address that voter registration debacle, though, for Democrats in Miami-Dade. How did the party let its advantage? And again, I realize that you've only been in this seat for less than a year or just a little over a year. Let's address that voter registration problem. How did the Democratic Party let its advantage over Republicans fall so precipitously in just the past few years?
Well, a couple of things have happened, but the biggest point of what's gone on is that the voter registration has been delegated to third party groups that had done a fantastic job, but they couldn't have the persuasive conversations about why to vote, why to register as a Democrat, mm-hmm. which is also why you've seen not just in Dade County, but the entire state, more and more people registering as no party affiliates.
Right.
And so you've seen a big intake of the NPAs. So one of the things when I came in and said, that's got to stop. This is the responsibility of the party. And so we have brought voter registration back inside the party. But that's why you've seen it, is because the party hasn't been doing consistent voter registration, mm-hmm. doing those investments. And part of it, which is also one of the first things I said, is why we have to make sure that we are regaining the trust of the people of our state. And part of that is rebranding. Part of that is going back to the basics of knocking on doors, mm-hmm. because people aren't registered to become a Democrat if they don't hear from us and they don't see the work that we're doing. And so we're bringing that back in-house, and we feel very confident that once it's in-house and we're doing the work, we're going to get this on track.
The voter registration swing in Miami-Dade from Democrats to Republicans is, of course, even more pronounced among Latinos. And in fact, given that two-thirds of Miami-Dade's population today is Latino, again, how did the Democrats manage to alienate so much of that crucial voting bloc to the point that analysts are warning that the GOP could win the county this year?
I think it goes back to our other parts of our conversation when and why we had to make moves in our local leadership. Because if we're not fielding candidates in every single race, from school board to county commission, city commission seats, to House and Senate and congressionals, we don't have people on the ground, you know, pitching the case of why the Democrats deserve their trust and should be elected. And so we have seen over the last few election cycles, less of that grassroots work being done, less of the door knocking. Look what happened in 2018. You know, we were able to, you know, I won Miami-Dade, won statewide as Commissioner of Agriculture by 6,753 votes. But afterwards, the party just stopped working. You know, they felt that there was a loss after we lost Andrew Gillum and Senator Nelson. And then during the pandemic, we all stayed home. Where the Republicans continue to work and knock on doors, but we are being very cautious.
But to my question, Chair Fried, what has the Democratic Party not done specifically to retain the Latino vote? What has been the big failing on that battlefield?
I think a couple of things. I think that, you know, when the misinformation started coming out in 2020, making a very egregious arguments that the Democratic Party is communist and socialist, which is insane of an argument. Their Democrats didn't stand up and say, I mean, no, we're not is not the answer. It's the understanding of where so many people, you know, I grew up in Miami. I'm a 305 girl through and through. My back neighbors were Cubans. I heard the stories. I was going to Cayo Ocho when I was 5 years old. And to be able to understand why so many people in Miami-Dade left their homes, left Cuba, left Venezuela, Colombia, to come to a better place. And to understand that Democrats are never going to allow that to happen again to them here in the state of Florida. We are the ones who are fighting for democracy, for freedom, for liberties. And unfortunately, we didn't make that argument in 2020. And so unfortunately, the misinformation stuck.
Okay. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with Florida's Democratic chair, Nikki Fried, about her suspension of South Florida chairpersons and fixing the party's fortunes here. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Chair Fried, I think the debate over the Latino vote that we were just talking about here actually brings us to a larger issue going on, especially inside the Miami-Dade Democratic Party, but the state party as well. And that's the growing acrimony between more moderate, pragmatic Democrats who think the party needs to steer more to the center, since Florida is now a red state, and more liberal or leftist Democrats who think the party needs to be more aggressively progressive to win Florida voters back. How can you mend these costly divisions?
The state of Florida has serious concerns and issues that are happening. Number one issue is property insurance. Number two issue is access to reproductive health care. Affordability in our state. We see corruption all throughout Miami-Dade, whether it is in the city, whether it is local, other local municipalities. And so we as Democrats have to come together and create this big tent that not only includes all the different perspectives inside of the prism of policies, but also make sure we're talking about issues that transcend partisan politics, making sure that we're talking about those issues that the American dream is built upon. And so regardless of where you put people on a spectrum, my goal and the job of the Florida Democratic Party is to build a big tent where those that are disenfranchised from this MAGA extremism on the Republican side understands that the Republicans in the state of Florida have completely left them behind, whether it's in book banning, educational opportunities, even protecting workers on the fields, on heat stroke, so many issues that the Republican Party continues to drag the people and suffocate us.
Right.
And so we have to make sure we're talking about the issues that are transcending partisan politics and build a huge tent that everybody knows that Democrats are continuing to show up, work for the people, put aside partisan differences, and get to work.
Okay. We have Emma on the line from Fort Lauderdale. Emma, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. What's your perspective here?
Hi there. I'm a longtime Democrat over in Broward County, and I just wanted a quick comment that since Chair Freed has come into the party, it is night and day. The communication, the staff, the rebuilding of the bylaw committees, of the fundraising committees, she has put her money where her mouth is. And I think this most recent sort of leadership change that she's implemented, to me, really only shows that she's able to make the tough decisions, not just the popular decisions, that are going to help us take Florida from becoming a red state back to a purple and a blue state. And okay. I just, you know, I have to say it, doing the same thing over and over again means nothing other than getting a headache. She's okay. making the changes necessary. She's listening to the different voices. She's cleaning house. And I'm so excited. And the proof is in the pudding. We saw it okay. in Tom Keene's recent HD race, and we're going to see it in the municipal races coming up in March.
Okay. Emma, thank you very much. Chair Freed, there you have a pretty strong endorsement from Broward County, which really is a blue stronghold for the Democratic Party in Florida still. But I want to go back to that question about the ideological rifts, because that also seems to be at play in Palm Beach County, where you also felt a need to suspend Chairperson Mindy Koch this month. Like Miami-Dade, Palm Beach has a tighter voter registration scenario at play today than, say, Broward does. So what, to your mind, were the major problems that moved you to take action there?
I think that we go back to the whole, what Emma was just saying, you know, look at what's happening in our state. And you look at, and she was referencing, you know, us flipping HD 35 in the center part of our state. Mm-hmm. And then we moved even in House District 118.
And again, remind us about HD 35 for our listeners being.
House District 35, which was a seat in the House in Central Florida. So it was kind of partly Orange and Osceola, mm-hmm. And which we had lost by a significant, I think, about 5 to 10 points in the 2022 election. Mm-hmm. We flipped that seat, winning by 5. Showing where the people of our state are moving into, and the independents, more importantly, are flipping for Democrats 65 to 70%. And we saw that in House District 118, which is down in the Miami-Dade area, Homestead. Mm-hmm. And two, we saw a 25-point swing last December in that race. People in our state are frustrated. They are frustrated with Republican policies, the inactions that they're seeing in Tallahassee, the suffocation of policies, and they want the Democratic Party to step up and show leadership that we are going to listen to everybody. We're going to focus on the issues that are on play, and that we're going to find solutions, whether it's the property insurance, whether it's general affordability, affordable housing. And that is where the leadership that I'm looking at is, how do we make sure that we are putting the best foot forward right. to represent the people of our state, regardless of their party affiliation?
And Chair Freed, just in the minute we have left then, I did want to ask you, what do you see as the key issues that are going to help the Democratic vote rebound in Florida this year? The kind of issues that are going to bring that huge contingent of, as you said, NPA, independent voters, back to Democrats? Is it abortion, insurance? What are you counting on to realize that?
Those two are the number one and number two issues. Property insurance. I don't care if you are living in Key West to Pensacola, whether you are have a $2 million home or barely able to make your mortgage. You are experiencing the insurance crisis like we have never seen here before in the state of Florida, and it is widespread across the entire state.
Right.
That issue alone is making people angry, frustrated, and want solutions that the Republican Party are just not even thinking about doing.
Okay.
The other is abortion.
Right.
You know, we're about to have within, by next Thursday, more likely, a ruling from the Florida Supreme Court upholding mm-hmm. a 15-week abortion ban, which means 30 days later, 6 weeks goes into place. 77% of Floridians did not want a 6-week abortion ban. They want government to stay out of those very private decisions.
Okay.
Those two issues alone are going to bring people out.
Well,
And they're going to make sure that right. they're holding Republicans accountable for these actions.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. Nikki Freed is the Florida State Democratic Party chair. Chair Freed, many thanks for being with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on today.
Still to come, saying so long to Miami Seaquarium and what it symbolized. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Suffice it to say, that TV ad for the Miami Seaquarium was made long ago in a different era. Last week, Miami-Dade County sent the Seaquarium an eviction notice after years of reports of structural decay and animal neglect and abuse, highlighted by last summer's death of the beloved orca Lolita. The county says the 69-year-old attraction is no longer in compliance with its lease on that 38-acre site near Key Biscayne, and it has told the Mexico-based company that operates it, the Dolphin Company, to pack up. Dolphin says it will fight the Miami Seaquarium eviction order, but the reality is that it's not exactly going to find a groundswell of support here. What was once an iconic Miami tourist destination looks more like a politically incorrect anachronism today. And so the consensus now seems to be not so much to mourn the Seaquarium, but rather to brainstorm a more fitting and humane way for Miami in the 21st century to showcase its identity as one of the world's most important seaside communities. What are your notions? How do we replace the Miami Seaquarium? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is someone who wrote an especially insightful editorial on the subject this week for the Miami Herald, Luisa Giannis. Luisa, thanks for being with us.
Tim, thank you for having me.
Let's bring our listeners up to speed on where things stand with the Miami-Dade County's move to evict the Miami Seaquarium. The county says it has until April 21st to vacate the Virginia Key site, right? But
right.
The Dolphin Company's president, Eduardo Albor, is vowing to fight the order in court, no?
He is, and he's very adamant that he's being fairly untreated by the county. You know, records show that the animals there are being not fully taken care of. And I don't know how he can combat that, but he's going to put up a fight for sure.
But as you point out, the county seems to have a pretty strong legal position here. No, I mean, especially given the laundry list of federal reports identifying the Seaquarium's lease infractions.
They do. And I think this time the county really needs it. They have the laundry list from the USDA, and it just and then the death of Lolita is, I think, what was the final blow. In past years, they've run into trouble, but they've always made fixes at the Seaquarium, and the county has forgiven them.
Yeah,
but I think this time is the county really needs it.
But
they've had enough.
Yeah, let's look at that USDA laundry list. A sea lion experiencing blindness from cataracts, bacteria, rusty bird cages, mold in the penguin house, et cetera. What were some of the more egregious points on that list that stood out for you?
I think the one that most people, struggle with is having a dolphin that would constantly hit its head against the concrete as an indication that it could not take this anymore.
Yeah.
And I think people read that, and other dolphins eating the concrete from their tank. It's just, I think it's become too much for people to hear how animals are living there.
Right. And a dolphin ingesting a nail too was one of the things that came out. But either way, Luisa, whether or not the Dolphin Company has a strong case in court, if it does take this to court, you make a very cogent point in your editorial this week. You write, and I quote, "The larger question is, how much will this really matter in the end? The Seaquarium's time is past. The Seaquarium has become a relic in today's South Florida, peddling a now troubling business model, forcing animals to perform for the price of a ticket," end quote. It's
right.
Obvious that in recent years, society's feelings about the animal entertainment attractions like the Seaquarium have soured considerably. The Barnum and Bailey Circus, for example, no longer has elephants and lions and horses performing. So, Luisa, what do you think brought about that shift in public sentiment regarding the Seaquarium? Was it last year's Lolita tragedy, or was it building long before that?
Yes, you know, the ad that you played made it sound so much fun. People would see that locally and want to go to this aquarium. People across the country would see that ad and say, oh, wow, I got to go there. But I think it's generational. I think that with the coming of the millennials, I think they did not find that kind of entertainment to their liking anymore. Once to see, you know, a dolphin go up in the air to grab a sardine from the hand of a trainer was, you know, magical. Yeah. But it isn't anymore. Right. Just the times have changed. The same, like as you mentioned, for circuses, for attractions like this one, for SeaWorld. And the death of Lolita is like, it made it so graphic. You know, this is, animals do die here. This is a life and death situation for these animals.
But that raises kind of an emotional question, though, Louisa. Should we as Miamians today feel bad about the cheerful nostalgia and fond memories this aquarium evokes for us? I mean, when I first took my kids there 25 years ago, the issues of animal abuse didn't really cross our minds that much, if at all. And now, was that because back then the attraction was still run well? I mean, were the dolphins and orcas and sea lions and the rest of the maritime menagerie there perhaps treated more humanely in those days? Or are we just kidding ourselves? And we should admit we were essentially mistreating wildlife for our children's amusement.
I guess it's a little bit of both. Back then, the attraction, when I was a kid, the highlight of a field trip, of our field trip season, was going to this aquarium. If you were in fourth, third, fifth grade, that was a almost a required trip. You knew you were going to go to this aquarium, and it was a big deal, and we enjoyed it. And the age of the facility also has played against it. Back then, it was fresh and clean, and and everything was so bright. And now it seems so dark. You know, just what happens in those waters is uncomfortable for people now.
Right. You point out in your editorial that Miami-Dade Commissioner Raquel Regalado observes now that this is just not a place you want to take your kids to anymore, right?
Right. Exactly. It just doesn't have the same allure.
Yeah.
For the change that we have gone through as a generational change, and the age of the facility, and we just don't enjoy that kind of thing anymore. You know, back in the day when I was a reporter, I interviewed Rick O'Berry, who was a dolphin catcher. He would catch the dolphins for this aquarium, and he's the first person to make me realize that this wasn't right.
Yeah,
I was sort of surprised, but he was like, "I did this, and I feel great guilt for doing this."
Interesting.
And he spent many years after, you know, his retirement trying to undo what he did to these animals. You know, it opened my eyes to thinking that this is not right.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with the Miami Herald's Louisa Janez about the eviction of the Miami Seaquarium. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. We have Ian on the line from Coral Gables. And Ian, you've got a point to make about South Carolina and how it maybe has a better model for this kind of thing. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup.
Hi. I only bring up, you know, Charleston Aquarium simply because it's one I've been to before. There are other ones that come to mind, like in Tampa. But really, I feel like, you know, a lot of people don't even realize that we have a second national park. And I think there's so much of an opportunity to have a true not-for-profit, even public-owned, conservation-minded aquarium to kind of introduce people to, you know, our actual backyard, not just, you know, animals performing for a show.
Right. No, thanks, Ian. And I'm glad you brought that up because it's a great segue to what I wanted to bring up with you next, Louisa, particularly from your editorial. You say that if this aquarium, as you write, is now an inhumane relic, let's talk now about what should replace it. You also mentioned in your editorial, this aquarium's eviction gives Miami-Dade County, quote, a chance to choose a new kind of attraction, such as a marine sanctuary or education center, something that won't bring in inordinate amounts of traffic, but has strong environmental value. Now, two words strike me in that sentence, traffic and environmental. Is it possible to create a 21st century alternative to this aquarium that's environmentally more humane and responsible, and which at the same time attracts paying visitors the way watching dolphins fly through the air did?
It's going to be a trick. I understand that, you know, that is going to be hard to do. But I think using that same generational change that we've talked about, I think if somebody can find a way to make this a rescue center, a way where you can see what a wrong that was done is being repaired, I think that would have some impact with a younger generation. Mm-hmm. The idea of fixing something that has been broken, and I think that idea would sell. Of course, they need I don't have the trick that they need, the spark that'll make it work. But I think there is such a thing out there that you can turn that into something else, flip it on its head, flip it on
right.
its side.
But that's an interesting point you make generationally, that perhaps kids today who were been raised in the milieu of climate change and all of those concerns would be perhaps more receptive to that sort of thing than, say, kids would a generation ago.
Exactly. I think an umbrella of climate change repair, I think it would work. And I think I think people would go if they can do that. You know, the admission price at the aquarium right now is $49. That's hefty. I don't know if people would pay that much for something different, but, you know, they have to try. You're going to have this structure in public land. It's going to be a trick if they do get this aquarium out of there, what to do with this land. And many people will fight for it. This is prime land. That aquarium was built when mm-hmm. we didn't value oceanfront property.
Right. Well, we have Cliff on the line, has some input here. Cliff, welcome to the South Florida Roundup.
Hey, Tim, how are you?
Fine. What's on your mind?
Well, I agree with everything that's been said. The place should have been closed down a long time ago. I guess I'll leave it up to myself to introduce that I used to work at this aquarium.
Right.
40
I'm sorry.
Years ago.
You are an ex-employee. No, yeah. Right. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I forgot to mention that.
No worries. No worries. I'll be a better guest than you are a host. So 40 years ago, this was exactly the same thing. What hasn't been mentioned, because the other whale has been dead for decades, is that bowl once held two full-sized killer whales. The first one's name was Hugo, who died back in the 1970s of a brain aneurysm. And even then, it was torturous to have two large mammals living in that tank. That tank, by the way, for comparison for listeners, was about 1/10 of the size of the smallest tank at SeaWorld in Orlando in those days. And that tank was carrying two whales. So
right.
it was cruel. And of course, Tokite, the killer whale known to the public as Lolita,
uh-huh.
She was gentle, and she was forced to work. She didn't do it alone. After Hugo died, they got her another mm-hmm. Co-worker, so to speak, a dolphin named Makani, who was in there. And P.S., I don't think that anybody is a war criminal for thinking that that their childhood memories of this aquarium were fantastic and fun. Mm-hmm. I mean, those were real memories. You just don't know what's going on with the performers, and mm-hmm. now we do. And
right.
it's time for that show. Anyway, great show, great
conversation. No. Thanks for those perspectives, Click, because that also, I think, speaks to what we were talking about earlier about the dolphin, for example, beating its head against the wall. And it's sort of in a disturbing way, right, Luisa? I mean, that those conditions can create that kind of psychological disturbance, let's say.
Right, and I think that the reality of that, and Cliff might know better, the reality of knowing that human quality that these animals are suffering has made the big difference, I think.
Yeah. Now, Luisa, in the 30 seconds we have left, I just also wanted to ask you, how important is it that we find a way to both create a more politically correct way of showcasing our identity as one of the world's premier oceanside communities, and at the same time monetize that identity the way the Sequarium did? If we can't do that, how will that affect the Miami brand moving forward?
I know, and that's an interesting point. Right now, when we're also trying to get rid of spring break, we're trying to
right.
get rid of
yeah.
things that have been iconic
right.
in our area. We are, I guess, we are going through a phase where we are, you know, readjusting ourselves, reinventing ourselves.
Good point.
You know, I don't know if you can ever have an attraction like this. So this was
right.
this is really iconic, and that word is overused, but this really was, you know, with the flipper thrown in, and that those shots of those dolphins up in the air.
Oh, sure.
It's hard to replicate that.
Well,
but we have to find something else.
We'll have to create. We'll have to create more Wynwood walls. In that regard. Luisa Janez is an editorial writer for the Miami Herald. Luisa, many thanks.
Thank you, Tim, for having me.
Still to come, should we be preparing for a new wave of Haitian refugees here? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. The violent gang takeover of Haiti this month is the sort of crisis that in the past has brought waves of refugees escaping the country by boat and arriving here, usually in the Florida Keys. Last year, for example, saw the largest influx in over two decades. That kind of exodus hasn't happened yet this year, and it may not at all. But either way, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis said this week he'll be mobilizing hundreds of law enforcement officers and soldiers, including his new civilian army, the Florida State Guard, to, quote, combat illegal vessels carrying Haitian migrants. We'll leave it to you to decide whether that's prudent preparation or just more of the governor's anti-immigrant grandstanding, or both. But it also raises the issue of how we should better and more humanely handle a rush of Haitian refugees if it comes, especially given the scenes of gang brutality and economic collapse in Haiti right now. Do you expect a Haitian refugee wave in the offing? How should we deal with it? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now to discuss those matters is Florida State Representative Dottie Joseph. She's a Haitian-American Democrat who represents North Miami and the 108th House District. Representative Joseph, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Representative, in a statement this week, you argue that Governor DeSantis' plan to mobilize law enforcement and soldiers to intercept vessels carrying Haitian refugees in order to, as he put it, protect our state is, as you put it, reckless political posturing that's just meant to feed conservative xenophobia. Why do you come to that conclusion?
Because that does nothing to actually help the problem either for Haitians or for Floridians. If he really wanted to help the problem, he could help curb the flow of guns that are being illegally smuggled from Florida into Haiti, which is directly contributing to the destabilization of the island nation.
Right. And I do want to get to that with you a little later in the conversation. Yeah.
I mean, there's a right approach and there's a wrong approach. The right approach upholds the rule of law, and the rule of law is clear both under U.S. law and under international law. If people are fleeing for whatever reason, there are some reasons that allow them to seek refuge in another country, including the United States. Right. So for those people to assert those claims, they legally have to arrive into the country to present those claims. Right. So either you're going to let them try to follow the law or you're going to obstruct the law.
Right. I also mentioned, though, political grandstanding in my intro. Do you feel also that perhaps the governor, as he's been wont to do on this issue in the past, is sort of looking, looking for a problem for a solution?
Absolutely. But it's not unique to him. Our failed political presidential candidate has taken to trying to be as right wing as possible as far as options go. And what we're seeing with a lot of these right wing extremist, primarily Republican candidates, is that they try to capitalize on culture wars to distract people from their own policy failures on economic issues impacting their constituency. Mm-hmm. What do I mean by that? So part of the culture war things have to do with wokeness and immigration. So immigration is a seminal piece of that, but it's also layered with a racist undertone of this replacement theory. So capitalizing on all of that, they use that for political gain to get people so riled up and focused on these kinds of culture war issues that you don't pay attention to the fact that, for example, Florida leads the nation in inflation. We have a workforce shortage and a whole host of other things.
However, given the record number of Haitian refugees who arrived on South Florida's shores last year, is it not reasonable for the governor to make preparations to keep local officials, for example, from being overwhelmed by the volume as many were last year?
Well, I don't know that we had a record number of Haitians arrive on Florida shores last year. I would question some of those statistics, because from my understanding, there have been other periods that have had much higher sea migration. We are seeing less of that, especially with the implementation of the humanitarian parole program, both not only for Haitians, but for Cuban migrants and for other people from other nationalities that are included in the program, that has definitely helped organize the flow. I think what people fail to understand is, when it comes to migration flow, if you give people a route or procedure that works, they will follow that procedure. The problem is we have a broken immigration system and we need comprehensive immigration reform, and nobody seems to have the political will to get it done.
Okay. Now, are you personally anticipating a new wave of Haitian refugees, Representative, given what's happening in Haiti right now? I mean, the gangs that control much of the country were burning down police stations just yesterday. There really is no rule of law there at the moment, and there may not be for some time. Is this an unprecedented crisis in Haiti? And if so, should we not be bracing for an especially desperate exodus?
So multiple questions there, and I'll try to tackle them piece by piece. So yes, this is an unprecedented crisis in Haiti, for sure. In my lifetime, I have never seen, particularly the capital area, in as much disarray as it is.
Right.
We have a lot of internally displaced people, but a lot of the people who have been fleeing the violence didn't just happen, you know, in the past couple of weeks. It's been going on for the past couple of years since the assassination of the president.
Right.
So a lot of those people have already been fleeing the country and have been going through various processes to make sure that they can go about things in a legal way.
Right.
Because of that, I am sure that those kinds of policies implemented at the federal level have significantly curbed the flow that we can anticipate going forward.
Okay.
I can't tell you what people will or will not do. I can tell you that from my time visiting the border in Texas, the last time we had a surge of migrants, that there are people who are preying on vulnerable populations, be they Haitians, Cubans, people from Nicaragua, El Salvador, who lie to them and give them false information about what to do. And a lot of them have ties, like political ties, of right-wing people who are feeding bad information to create the appearance of a crisis when there often is not one.
Okay. I want to take a call now. We have Al on the line from Miami. Al, what is your perspective on this problem? Or a problem, I should say, that really hasn't arisen, but many people feel could.
Yes, it could. Good afternoon, Representative Doughty. I like her. She's a good fighter. But, you know, the reason why somebody needs to explain to the public why Haitian refugees are leaving Haiti to come here is because the U.S. government refused Haitian the right to elect the president. Every time Haitian elect a good president, the U.S. said the Batman is ready to make a coup d'etat. Twice Haitian are a victim of coup d'etat every time, I mean, when they elect the right president. When they got the wrong, when the U.S. State Department imposed somebody that is a deviant, an outlaw, in Haiti, and take the place of the Haitian people and refuse the Haitian the right to elect a good president in Haiti.
Okay.
That needs to stop. It needs to stop right now, and somebody needs to go to explain to the public the reason why Haitians are leaving Haiti to come here is because the U.S. government refused the Haitian the right to elect a good government in Haiti.
Well, thank you very much, Al. Representative Joseph, I want you to respond to Al's call, but first I need to remind people this is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Florida State Representative Dottie Joseph about a possible wave of Haitian refugees escaping Haiti's violent crisis. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Representative Joseph, the point that Al just brought up, that the United States bears a lot of political responsibility in his mind for this crisis. How would you frame that yourself?
I want to thank Al for calling in to highlight that point, because what he just identified is a certain level of interference by not just the United States, but lots of countries literally throughout the world. We especially see the United States being active in regime change, selection, et cetera, whatever you want to call it. A lot in the Latin America and the Caribbean, as well as Africa. What does that look like in terms of Haiti? Well, I'm not going to get into all of the history, but we've seen where the United States has gotten involved positively, and we've seen where the United States has gotten involved negatively. Mm-hmm. The problem with the negative intervention is it denies the people's right to self-determination. Mm-hmm. It denies any nation's right to select who they want to lead for themselves, because either that selected candidate does not support U.S. business interests, does not support U.S. national security interests, or maybe is just a little too close to some of the governments that the United States does not want close to our borders, right? So those are some of the things that contribute to the United States' involvement in a negative way.
Okay.
The United States has sometimes been involved in a positive way, so I want to acknowledge that.
Sure.
But the negative, I will let callers know, is ingrained in the Haitian psyche.
Yes.
From the time where, you know, with the backing of U.S. Right. Marines, and there was a coup d'etat, mm-hmm. they went and literally took money out of the Haitian National Bank.
There's definitely a long history there. Let's pivot back to Florida, though, Representative. If this refugee wave does come, you say in your statement that our response has to be more, quote, legal and humane than it's been in the past. What should we do differently this time to better handle the refugee influx if it comes, and handle it, as you say, more humanely?
Simple. We should follow the law. We should adequately resource the federal government with Customs and Border Patrol people and the people who are tasked, specifically asylum officers, with helping process people's claims. That also means that we allot for adequate language services for translation, mm-hmm. so that people aren't just trying to struggle to speak English or Spanish or even French, and sometimes none of which help people really convey their claim in Haitian Creole.
Yeah.
So once people are able to articulate whatever their claim is, then you'll be able to adequately process them. What does processing them look like? That means making sure that you treat them like any other immigrant group. We have examples of how that can be done well, or at least a little bit better, with mm-hmm. Afghanistan. We have people who came from the Ukraine.
That's another example.
Lots of countries. Mm-hmm. So it's not that we can't do it. It's not that we don't have the funds to do it. The question is, why would we treat one group differently from another? Whether they're coming from Israel or Palestine. We see here, you talking about Florida, the governor mm-hmm. literally sent planes to Israel, even though he wasn't successful and had to have intervention from the federal government, because it's the federal government's purview to take care of its citizens.
Right.
Representative,
in the minute we have left, I also want to touch on another important point you alluded to earlier, and that you also made in your statement this week, and that's your reminder that Florida is the chief source of the high power guns that are trafficked to the gangs that now terrorize Haiti. You argue that since that's the case, Florida has a certain obligation to receive Haitians escaping those heavily armed gangs. Do you think that message resonates here?
Whether or not it resonates is irrelevant, and it's not about Florida. I think the United States, Florida is not separate from the United States. Any country has certain obligations under international and its own national laws, right? Mm-hmm. So there's no difference between Florida and other places when it comes to that. The question is, what are we doing to not contribute to the root causes of instability that lead people to have to leave their countries of origins in the first place?
Right.
So Otherwise, we're going to keep putting band-aids on issues that require surgery.
I'm going to have to leave it there, Representative. Thank you. Democratic Florida State Representative Dottie Joseph is a Haitian American who represents North Miami and the 108th House District. Representative Joseph, many thanks.
Thank you.
Finally on the roundup, Miami is getting ready to serve. The 2024 Miami Open starts this Sunday, March 17th, at Hard Rock Stadium in Miami Gardens. The next 2 weeks will feature some of the world's best tennis players hitting the hard courts in sunny South Florida. And to make this year's Miami Open even better, the tournament will include the debut of wheelchair tennis and South Florida's new favorite sport, Major League Pickleball. Yeah, you can't escape it, folks. It's everywhere. Everywhere. So that's Game, Set, Match for today's South Florida Roundup. It's produced by Helen Acevedo with help from Polly Landis. Katie Munoz is our Director of Original Live Programming. Mateo Sanchez is Digital Editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's Vice President of News. The Vice President of Radio and the show's Technical Supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias. Merci. Obrigado.
WLRN Public Media.